It is another Saturday morning in CCO land, coming up to 7:45, time once again for another wine chat with our friend from Haskell's, Ted Farrell. Good morning, Ted. What a beautiful day.
Isn't it, though, just marvelous? You know, there are hints of spring, hints of spring. Of course, last night I had to sit out at a track meet, and you would have thought I should have been ice fishing the way I was bundled up.
Yeah, I turned the heat back on. I mean, come on. But
I know. Mother Nature loves to tempt us, doesn't she?
Yes, here in the Theater of Seasons. Well, what's going on today on our wine chat?
Well, Denny, do you know what the first Saturday in May means?
For me, you mean personally or what? No, tell me.
Maybe. Well, it's the running of the roses, and today is the Kentucky Derby. That's
absolutely
that first Saturday.
I'm going to set aside my mint julep, and we'll get on with the show.
Well, perfect. That's what we're going to talk about. So today might not be a proper wine chat. It might be a little bit more of a spirited bourbon chat because, you know what, with the running of the roses, that is the historical drink that they love to serve at the Kentucky Derby, and it's called the mint julep, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But one of the key ingredients in a mint julep is bourbon. Now, bourbon is the American spirit. Now, the reason why they say that is because that is America's spirit that we love. And we actually, it is the only alcoholic beverage that has congressional legislation written about it of what it can and cannot be called by law. Now, the reason being is that we have a rich, rich history of distillation and bourbon in our country because, you know, right around before our country was even formed, we had a lot of immigrants coming in from the Scots-Irish, the Scots themselves, the Germans and whatnot, and they were settling in what at the time was Virginia, but really it was the area of Kentucky, and these folks were sitting down, and they brought these distillation processes to the United States. You know, quite frankly, they say George Washington not only is the father of our country, but he's also the father of distillation. His big Mount Vernon operation at the time, which was about 8,000 acres of farming and all that, actually never made money until he put a distillery on premise and started selling whiskey, and he all of a sudden became a very, very wealthy man, besides land wealth, but I mean monetarily a lot of wealth. And so distillation has a rich, rich history. I mean, we had the old rebellion, the whiskey rebellion, in about, 1790-some, because they decided to tax it. And so distillation has always been an important part because, you know, years and years ago, believe it or not, those settlers didn't have a Haskell's to go buy their whiskey, so most of them had to make it. Now, usually what they did when they were making whiskeys is that they were making it with any of the kind of grains that were left over from the harvest. So usually the most abundant grain that was left over because it was used for feed was corn. Now, corn is a very integral part of bourbon because, again, there was the abundance of that. People grew the corn to feed the animals, but they always had some left over, and so why not throw that into your mash bill? So they would sit and distill that, and then, you know, if you made too much, what did you do? You put it in an oak barrel to store it, and then eventually maybe even ship it if you're a prosperous distiller. So the tradition behind distilling it from corn and then putting it inside an oak barrel, you know, started by, you know, quite frankly, necessity. That's what you had, that's what you used, and that's what you did. And that tradition went on for years and years, where in and around the area of Kentucky, they kind of found that this area in particular was just fantastic for distillation. Not only did they have the fertile fields to make the corn, but more importantly, what they had was fantastic water. The water down there, they have all these limestone deposits that literally will filter out any of the iron for the water. So the water was just terrific and perfect to make wonderful, wonderful distilled product and then age it inside the barrel. So it was opportunities, but also circumstances in which most of those distillers congregated down and around Kentucky. Now, even still to this day, about 95% of the bourbon that is made in the United States is still made in Kentucky. So, in rich tradition, you have, they also will say, and this is the kind of tricky part, and I guess it's left for the historians to discuss, who was the proper father of bourbon. A lot of people will point the finger at a fellow named Elijah Craig, but there's also Colonel Taylor. There's all sorts of rich history. We're even to the point where recently the Buffalo Trace Distillery, which is a very famous distillery down in Kentucky, was doing a renovation. And as they were doing the renovation, they scooped up what they call the bourbon Pompeii, so to speak, where they were digging up and they wanted to expand and have a hospitality center. And once they started doing some digging, they realized that there were some old fermentation tanks and old distillery parts that were buried up years ago. And they think it was Colonel Taylor's original distillery. So now it's more of a historical site. So you walk in there and it's, you know, archaeologists scraping away at the remnants of these great distilleries. And it's truly amazing. And, you know, some of it reason why they probably buried it up because it was so close to the river that they probably got sick and tired of every spring getting it flooded out. So they moved shop, they buried it up. And because even recently, this spring, there were huge floods in and around Kentucky that actually brought the water levels even higher than they were used to down at the Buffalo Trace and many other distilleries. But that's the thing. So it's our American spirit. And so to be a little bit French-esque, what the United States Congress did in about 1964 is they wrote the Bourbon Act, and they put down the guidelines of what can and cannot be called bourbon. And so they sat down and they worked several things out. First and foremost, it goes back to that tradition of corn. So your corn or your bill mash bill inside that distillate has to be at least 51% corn based. You can have more, but you have to have at least 51% corn in that mash. And the mash is that big porridge that they grind up, get it kind of all going. It starts fermenting, they add some yeast, and that's what they distill. So that's the mash bill has that. They could put other things in there, rye, et cetera, but at least 51% corn. Next, and this is a kind of a funny little thing, once they distill it, and there's some technical things that, you know, most listeners don't really care about, that it can only come off the still at about 190 proof, and then they put it in a barrel only at about 120 proof. There's some of that that's more, leave that up to the chemists and the distillers. But the bigger important thing is they put it in a brand new charred oak barrel. Now, there's a couple different things with this. Yes, there's the tradition of putting that stuff into the barrel and then eventually shipping it out. But more importantly, or the little sneaky political deal was, the senator that was from Missouri at the time, Missouri has some of the largest cooperages even still to this day in the United States. So he wrote that new charred barrel, and the emphasis on new, that you have to age your distillate in, is because he wanted to perpetuate the cooperage industry in Missouri. But that's the rule you have to follow. So all these distillers will put that what they call White Dog. Now, White Dog, quite frankly, is moonshine. When you see that stuff come off the still, it is clear as water, and it can burn even harder than fire. It's real hot. But it goes inside those barrels, and they age it. Now, there isn't a proper definition by law of how long they have to age it for, but in order to export it to Europe, it has to be aged at least 2 years in order to call it any form of whiskey. But there's other rules and regulations. You don't have to do it. But if you have a straight bourbon whiskey, there's no colors added to it, and it has to be aged for at least 2 years. Then there's another derivation of it called bottled in bond. Now, bottled in bond has to come from one distiller, one particular distillery, in one particular season. And once all that whiskey comes off, it goes into a particular rickhouse. The rickhouse is a huge, huge warehouse in which they store all this. They lock it up, and they even have a government agent coming in, making sure that there's no tomfoolery going on, and they regulate that. So that is a bottled in bond. And so that has to be a minimum as well, aged 4 years. So that's a little derivation of it. But the overall rule is it can be aged for just a year or two, but they really want that color. And that also goes back to their tradition of putting those barrels on a boat, floating it from Kentucky down to down to like New Orleans, because that was their biggest market, to sell all that. Now, there is some controversy in there of who actually named Bourbon. Was it from Bourbon County, Kentucky, or was it because it was going to Bourbon Street? But again, that's a fun topic for all those historians to talk about, have a glass of bourbon and discuss all that. So that is kind of the quick setup of bourbons. And there's great bourbons all across. People are making it. There's even a Minnesota bourbon right now. I believe it's Cantilever. They're making them over in Oregon. They're making them in Colorado just by following those simple recipes. But still, the epicenter of the bourbon markets is down in Kentucky, in and around Louisville, where the Kentucky Derby is going on. So the big hook is, now that they love all their bourbons and that's so abundant, that they're going to make this drink called the mint julep. Now, a julep, the derivation of that particular word, believe it or not, comes from Arabic, and eventually it migrated, you know, with the history of the Moors controlling Spain, etc. It got into the Iberian Peninsula and eventually up into England. But a julep literally translates, it was julep, which means rose water. And usually what that means is you would infuse water with some different minerals, different herbs, whatnot, maybe even a little sugar to make it taste good. It was more on the medicinal side. Now, if you look at some drinks like that, there's the hot toddy. The hot toddy is real simple. It's water, some sugar, and whatever your remedy is. And that's kind of what the julep was based on. So the mint julep has its history, believe it or not, in and around Spain because of the Moors that were there. But eventually, leave it to Americans to turn that kind of medicine in real good medicine that you would want to sit down and drink while you're sitting there watching the Kentucky Derby. And the julep is such a simple drink, Denny. It is simply one equal part of bourbon, one equal part of simple syrup. Now, simple syrup, some people are like, oh, I have to go to the store and buy it. You don't really have to do that, because simple syrup is quite that. It is one part sugar, one part water. Warm it up on your stovetop to allow that sugar to melt and infuse with the water. Now you have simple syrup. And then the other two ingredients in a mint julep, go figure, is mint and then shaved ice. Now, shaved ice is kind of a key point, or smaller cube, real small cubed ice, because it's so simple, so easy to make, where you put that bourbon in there in equal part and then an equal part of the simple syrup. You mull in the mint, but that those smaller ice cubes melt a little bit faster. That will dilute the bourbon and also dilute the drink and make it easy to drink and enjoy. So it's a great little drink. And, you know, quite frankly, there's great bourbons out there. There's some very expensive ones, but one of my favorites is called Jeffers Creek. It's very simple, very easy, and a terrific one to blend for only about $17.99. It's a great bourbon, Denny.
And I bet you can find that to make whatever ingredients. What a great show. There's so much. I didn't realize there was so much history. But let's tell folks about Haskell's. They can get right there and make their own mint julep.
You are correct. You know, the guys at Haskell's, you know, can't pick the horse for you, but they can help you make the drink. So if you win, you have something to enjoy with. Or if you lose, you have this, something to commiserate with. And there's all sorts of Haskell's all around town. There's a Haskell's in downtown Minneapolis with free parking on the weekends. There's a Haskell's in Minnetonka right across from the Ridgedale Shopping Center. There's a Haskell's in Highland Village, also down in Lomans Plaza in Bloomington. There's a Haskell's right in downtown Excelsior if you want to go out on the lake. There's also a Haskell's at White Bear Lake, Stillwater, if you're headed out toward the river, or if you're headed down south, a Haskell's right off of Faribault. There's a Haskell's on your way up to north if you're going to Plymouth, or stop by our super cellar in Maple Grove to see what's going on, and they'll take care of it. A little reminder, today is the last day of our spring sale. Actually, tomorrow is the last day of the sales, to take advantage of that, but also to come in and stock up for any of your Kentucky Derby needs. And if you can't do any of that, always stop by Haskell's.com 24/7, and we'll take care of it. We'll even deliver it to you, Denny.
Absolutely. I know that for a fact. Ted, thanks so much. Enjoy this weekend and this coming week's weather, and let's talk next week.
I look forward to that, Denny.
Thank you, Ted. Ted Farrell from Haskell's.